This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact, right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Adam Scott, and we're in the business impact of government actions business. That's right. That's what we bring to light today, every day. Check us out at www.bgov.com. Once you do, you'll be completely satisfied that Bloomberg Government is the only information service provider in D.C. that focuses on the business impact of government actions. We've partnered with our friends at Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, bringing that concept here to the airwaves every Thursday at 11 AM and Fridays at 2:30. You want to find out more? Take a look at www.bgov.com. That's BGOV.com. Today on Capital Impact, we're bringing healthcare into focus. It's a hot topic. It's an election year, so of course it's a hot topic. In 2008, in fact, America spent $2.4 trillion on healthcare. But get this, we still came in last among major industrialized nations in the Commonwealth Fund's National Scoreboard on Health System Performance. We'll talk about that a little bit later on. But analysts estimate that about 30% of our spending is ineffective or redundant, or just on inappropriate care. We've got Brian Rye, a healthcare finance analyst with BGov. He's written a study entitled Comparative Effectiveness Research, Implications for the Healthcare Industry. Is the money being spent wisely? Brian's going to tell us in a little while. We'll also have our congressional analyst, Lauren Duggan, who's become somewhat of a regular on the program, bringing us Congress Tracker. He'll talk about health care and probably some student loan stuff and a whole bunch more. What to watch out for on Capitol Hill in the next few days. But we'll start our program by examining a joint federal-state program that's been around for about 50 years. Of course, we're talking about Medicaid. Approximately 16 million people are going to become eligible for Medicaid under the new health care law. Why are states now pushing for private companies? Chris Flavelle wrote a study entitled Managed Care, Push Not Explained by Medicaid Cost Growth Alone. And he joins us here today to discuss it. Hey, how are you?
Great. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. So you hear a lot about, especially in the healthcare space, people talking about a couple of different words, and they use them interchangeably, Medicare, Medicaid. Completely not interchangeable, completely different. Why don't you define the two of them for us right now?
Sure, you're right. Those two terms do get used together a lot. It's important to recognize they're different. Medicare is for the elderly, 65 and up, and it's totally funded by the federal government. Medicaid is for the poor and the disabled, run by the states and then financed with help from the federal government. So different populations and different issues inside each program.
You mentioned something there that I wanted to expand on, funded by the federal government. That's about to change somewhat.
Yes. Everyone in this city talks about the deficit and the problem and the need to cut spending. The question is, who do you cut? In the current election, both parties are talking about how to control Medicare spending. You don't hear a lot about Medicaid. I think part of the reason is people on Medicare or who are about to become eligible for Medicare, they tend to vote in pretty high numbers. People who care about Medicaid are those who are out of a job, don't make a lot of money, have some sort of an illness, and so don't always get involved to the same degree in politics, and so aren't often talked about. But it's important to remember that this is an extremely important program from the point of view of actual dollars out the door. Right now, the U.S. spends almost $500 billion a year on Medicaid, huge amount of money, and with the new health care law, if it survives the Supreme Court, that amount will go up. So what we've got to talk about is how do you control the growth of the program in a way that doesn't hurt people?
You're talking about hurting people, starting with just state houses themselves. They're starting to feel a little bit of a crunch, potentially. Is it warranted?
So one of the constant concerns that you hear from states is Medicaid, huge part of their budget. And with the recession, two things happened. More people were poor, needed help getting health insurance, and also tax revenues were down. So states had more trouble paying for programs like Medicaid. Now, the result was more and more pressure from state governments to shift this program into plans run by private insurance companies. And the reason that's a really important point is it's harder to control spending if you can't budget it. And right now, Medicaid traditionally is just $1 in, $1 out. You go to the doctor if you're on Medicaid. Your doctor sends a bill to the state. State pays him. Under private plans, the state can say at the outset of the year, here's what we'll pay. Mm-hmm. Which insurance company will pay for it? Totally different system. The question is, what does it mean for healthcare providers? Hospitals, doctors, drug companies, they're worried that if private plans find ways to bring down spending, mm-hmm. that's less revenue for them.
So some of the people who may be potential losers in this, give me an example of a winner or a loser as we move forward. I mean, it sounds like we're almost grandfathering in what the federal government has decided to fund for years. And as it moves forward potentially to the state level, it would be wise to shop around. Or would it?
Well, there's an ideology issue here. The ideology says anytime you have more competition, you'll get better results.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, results at whose expense? Now, if you're the state and you're looking to save money, certainly by going to different private plans saying, who can provide these healthcare services for poor most cheaply, probably you're going to control costs. The question, as you said, is who loses? Does that mean lower payments for hospitals? Does it mean less care for people on the program?
Mm-hmm.
And what does it mean down the road for the actual health outcomes of people covered? If they can't get in to see a doctor or can't get to a hospital, does that mean they're sicker down the road,
yeah.
and so we all pay more later?
Mortality rates start to increase. I mean, I mentioned at the top of the program that we were number one in people who had an illness that potentially could lead to death but could have been treated prior. It's like before the age of 75.
That's right. And what you see on Medicaid is when you compare health outcomes, access to care, people on this program for the poor versus people on commercial plans paid for by their employer, or people on Medicare, outcomes are much lower for Medicaid. So one of the issues for state governments as they try and cut spending or at least control spending growth is how do they do it without hurting healthcare providers like hospitals and also without hurting people on the plan?
Right. We're talking to Christopher Flavelle. Say that three times real fast. He's the author of a study, Managed Care, Pushed Not Explained by Medicaid Growth, a cost growth alone, here on Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact. It's Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, and governors themselves are a little bit concerned as well. We talked about some of the state legislators. As we look at governors now, I found a quote from Rick Scott. He says that since 1999, his budget for Medicaid has increased almost 180%. Moving forward, are all governors in the same boat, or are there pockets where, you know what, we'll be able to manage this?
Yeah, well, certainly with any program, you get huge variation state to state. But on the average, there certainly is cost growth in Medicaid. What we tried to do at Bloomberg Government is separate the meaningful change from the noise.
Mm-hmm.
So pull out population growth, pull out inflation. What we found was, to our surprise, actual spending on Medicaid hasn't changed that much in the last 10 years. That doesn't mean it won't. If this new health care law survives the Supreme Court, many more people will be on Medicaid, and states will have an issue trying to find that money. But for now, the idea that spending growth is unsustainable doesn't seem to hold up.
It's an election year. What kind of things is Mitt Romney saying? We know what the president's talking about. What about Mitt Romney at this point?
There's a long-standing policy proposal from Republicans to take Medicaid and turn it into what they call a block grant. What that means is, instead of the federal government just paying some share of the bill every year, they'll say to the states, here's how much money we'll give you. It's all you've got. Figure out what you want to do with it for Medicaid. And that block grant will go up by a fixed percent every year. I think Mitt Romney said inflation plus one percentage point. That would shift some of the burden onto the states, but also give them more freedom to decide how they spend the money, fewer federal regulations and restrictions. Now, I think providers are concerned that if states don't have to answer the federal government for how they spend Medicaid dollars, that could hurt some groups, and they'll have less lobbying options. They can't go to the federal government and say, this isn't fair to us. So there's a battle right now. Will Medicaid stay the way it currently is, or will Mitt Romney, if he wins, succeed in changing it to essentially a program where the federal government says to the states, here's your money, you work it out?
I want to bring someone else into the conversation now. His name is Brian Rye. He's a healthcare finance analyst with Bloomberg Government. He's authored a new study entitled Comparative Effectiveness Research, Implications for the Healthcare Industry. Brian, welcome to the program.
Ellen, thanks for having me.
Thank you very much for joining this this in-depth healthcare discussion here on Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500. So back in June of 2009, Senator Max Baucus spoke at length at the Brookings Institute on this very topic, this comparative effectiveness research. And one funny thing that came out of it was the fact that they were so sick of talking about this on the Hill, they wanted to rename it. And one of the names they threw out was Fred. Let's just call it Fred, because this just doesn't make any sense. But that aside, we talked about the number of deaths that could have been prevented before the age of 75. We rank number one, the U.S. does. One may say that the money is being spent in the wrong places or on the wrong whatever. What is CER and how is that going to help us? We're just playing this.
So comparative effectiveness research essentially is trying to look at currently available therapies and see which ones work best for different people for the same disease. So, for example, you and I may both be dealing with high cholesterol. Well, for you, maybe...
I actually am.
maybe one particular... We'll turn this around. Maybe okay. one particular drug would work best for you, whereas perhaps for me, drugs wouldn't be the best option, and maybe just simple changes in diet and exercise would be best. Healthcare is one of the few marketplaces where you sort of go into a doctor's office with a particular problem and don't really know how a treatment's going to work for you before you try it. And that's where CER, comparative effectiveness research, tries to come in. The idea is that, okay, we'll study drug A versus drug B, or maybe device A versus drug A, and see which ones give the best outcome, and then hopefully give patients and their providers better information to make those decisions.
So the results come back from the comparative effectiveness research studies. Who's going to see them? I mean, HIPAA is going to prevent people from knowing that I, Alan Scott, have a cholesterol problem, correct?
That's right. If they're doing their job,
correct.
You know, one of the core problems here, or criticisms, if you will, of the broad idea of comparative effectiveness research, and that is, you know, studies, clinical trials are conducted, and you get an answer, and the answer is usually an average. And so, we'll make up a number of 1,000 patients with a given disease. You know, X percent show that they respond better on drug A versus drug B. Well, for some people, maybe a subgroup of patients, drug B is actually better. And so the concern is that either an insurance company or the government at large might make a broad, sort of wide-ranging coverage decision or reimbursement decision and say, okay, drug A worked better than drug B in this trial, so we're only going to cover drug A, even though drug B may work better for a lot of people.
Right. So I'm getting the sense that there's a little bit of back and forth here. There's a couple of sides to this argument. What are the sides? Who's winning? What's going on?
So the sides are different, not only here in the U.S., but around the world as well. In the U.K., Canada, and Australia, for example, a key component of comparative effectiveness research is cost effectiveness research. And understanding, sure, a new drug may come along that extends lives or improves the quality of your life, but is it worth it? You know, that has been a sort of a tougher sell here in the United States, fears of rationing or limiting treatment options or telling physicians how they're going to run their practice. So here in the U.S., most of the discussions have been around clinical comparative effectiveness. And one of the problems is we're not sure that just sticking with that strategy is going to save the healthcare system money in the long run, if that's a concern, if that's something you're interested in. In 2007, for example, the Congressional Budget Office issued a report saying that, well, if you just confined your activities to the clinical side of things and didn't really change the way Medicare could reimburse or change their criteria, you would actually wind up spending more money running the studies than you actually did in savings that would be produced as a result of those studies.
Max Baucus was very, very vocal in the creation of PCOR. PCOR-E. Tell me a little bit about that. I mean, it's an acronym that means a lot and has taken on a lot of weight as we move forward now.
So the Obama administration has done a great deal and has probably given unprecedented levels of support to CER activities. You mentioned PCORI, the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, was established and funded as part of the Affordable Care Act back in 2010, and given a 10-year budget of about $3.5 billion, paid for both from general appropriations as well as fees on public and private insurance plans. That followed in the 2009 stimulus bill. The president carved out $1.1 billion for three different areas within HHS to fund and communicate the findings of comparative effectiveness research. So, again, the Obama administration views this as a high priority in terms of helping to, get the message out there for what treatments are best for patients.
We're speaking with Brian Rye, healthcare financial analyst with Bloomberg Government. He's authored a study, Comparative Effectiveness Research Implications for the Healthcare Industry. We've also got Chris Flavelle with us. Chris, one quick question for you real quick. Supreme Court battle as we talk about Medicaid. We're all talking about healthcare here at this point. Where does the fight stand? What's going to happen?
So we're waiting for the Supreme Court to rule. That ruling should come down sometime at the end of June, possibly early July. People have their handicaps. Some believe it'll be 5-4 or something. It could go even more split, 7-2. No one knows. It's a guessing game. The administration has said they think the law is going to stand. They're not talking, at least, about what they would do if it fell. Right now, no one knows.
Gotcha. Turning over to Brian, winners and losers at this point? Do we have any? Can we define anything as of yet?
Well, I think for comparative effectiveness research, you know, losers are probably going to be those biotech companies who make high-end biologics, you know, the ones that cost a lot of money. I think of an example is cancer. Back in 2008 in the UK, where they do consider cost as a component of this analysis, they declined to recommend that the National Health Service, reimburse providers for the use of four different drugs for kidney cancer. Well, all four of those drugs are approved in available here in the U.S., and the folks in the U.K. very simply said, we don't think this is a cost-effective use of the resources. So, you know, those biotech companies, you know, leaders in the biotech field include Amgen, Gilead, those type companies, there's going to be more pressure on those companies going forward to demonstrate, you know, why their drugs are worth the money that it is. That leads into a winner. Now, we think, and that's going to be makers of diagnostics. You know, those companies that can help beforehand identify patients where drugs are most likely to work will assist in sort of justifying those prices, because now you're not saying, well, we're going to give this drug to 1,000 patients knowing that it's probably only going to work in 100. You're going to pick out those 100 beforehand, make sure they're the ones that get the therapies. And the other 900, well, we'll move on and see what other therapies are best for them.
Ryan, talking about what comparative effectiveness research means for insurance companies, because right now they have to decide what to pay for and what not to pay for. If you don't have this kind of research funded by some third party, the federal government, who decides, and how do insurance companies know what they should pay for and what they shouldn't?
Well, as you can imagine, that's a great question. Insurance companies are big supporters of comparative effectiveness research, especially their own. You know, there's been a big push from these companies to fund their own programs. I think of WellPoint Health Systems, which actually acquired a company several years ago that specialized in this. They put forth their own comparative effectiveness research guidelines. Because that's one issue that these folks struggle with is, there's not an agency like the FDA to sort of give that seal of approval that the studies not only were produced the results that they did, but that they were conducted well, that there's not a bias or other statistical problem. So you don't have those things. Well, you're trying to get there, and WellPoint and others are trying to do that. What they'll do with the results is typically they're wary of simply saying, well, we're not going to cover a drug based on the results of a comparative effectiveness study. But what they will say is, well, maybe for a group of drugs that are deemed to be clinically similar because of a CER study, we'll stipulate that our providers must prescribe the lower cost therapy first. And then if a patient doesn't get better on that drug, then they can progress to the second therapy. The so-called step therapy approach, as you can imagine, isn't thought of very well by those high-end drug companies that make the higher cost versions, but it is a reality.
Chris Flavelle, Brian Rye, a couple of analysts with Bloomberg Government who, Chris, you've authored an outstanding study, Managed Care, Push Not Explained by Medicaid Cost Growth Alone. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us. Brian, I want you to stick around because joining us on the phone now, I've got our guy in Congress, our man on the Hill. His name is Lauren Duggan. Lauren, how are you?
Very well, Alan. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us. We want to stick with the theme of health care. The House Energy and Commerce Subcommittee marked up draft legislation that would reauthorize the Food and Drug Administration user fee programs for prescription drug and medical devices and such. Where are we now with what's going on?
Well, I'm actually glad we have Brian here because I know he knows a lot about this subject. But where we are is the Senate Committee, the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, reported out its own version of that bill, and that's awaiting floor action any day now in the Senate. The House is earlier in that process. The subcommittee has its version. That'll go to the full Energy and Commerce Committee, and then that will come out to the floor. This is considered a must-pass piece of legislation because the program for user fees will expire on September 30th unless Congress acts. So any must-pass piece of legislation can attract other policy areas to it. In this case, healthcare is always a big issue. Prescription drugs are a big issue. The FDA is a big issue. So you can definitely see this bill being one that will have other issues come up in the context of the debate. But it may be an area where we see real action this year with Republicans in the House and Democrats in the Senate coming to some sort of agreement. And Brian, I don't know if you have anything to weigh in on the specifics, but my understanding is the basis of this bill is an agreement between the FDA and the industries that would be regulated. Is that your thoughts on that?
You're exactly right. You know, what happens is Congress has asked the FDA and industry participants, both in the drug, biotech, and device industries, to sort of get together, which they did over the course of the past year, and hammer out a recommendation both on the level of user fees to be paid by the industry. For example, when you're applying for approval of a new drug, you would pay a fee to the FDA. So agreeing on that level of fees, as well as the metrics that the FDA would try to hit, will try to respond to an application within a certain number of months. Once the FDA has that proposal, they then forwarded that to Congress, and that serves as the basis, you know, for this legislation. And as you said, this is must-pass. And for example, in the pharmaceutical industry, drugs funds from drug companies now fund over 60% of the FDA's review activities. So, you know, without that, they've been on record as saying they would have to lay off 2,000 reviewers. And if you think it takes a while to get a new drug on the market now, just wait until that happens.
All right, so we've got that happening on the Hill right now. They're back, obviously. That's why Lauren's not here with us in studio, as he has been the past few weeks. Lauren, tell us about H.R. 4310, the National Defense Authorization Act. You know, it's nothing big for 2013, just, you know, need money for procurement of aircraft, shipbuilding, education. Little things. Where does that stand at this point?
Well, that's being marked up on Wednesday by the Armed Services Committee in the House, and that's just the beginning of its process as well. It would authorize $554 billion for defense programs. Now, that's not just the Pentagon. That's also some Energy Department programs that deal with national security. And the level it would set is about $4 billion more than requested. Now, this bill doesn't actually give the money to the department. That's the appropriations process, a separate thing that we've talked about on this show before. Mm-hmm. This really sets broad policy for the department. So here's the total amount Congress can provide for these things, but then there's also different policy proposals. So Congress will debate weapon systems, for example, whether to ramp them up or, you know, take them down in some areas. It can also become a forum to debate detention policy, and that was one of the issues that helped bog down the bill a little bit last year, although they were able to come to an agreement to get a final bill. Other things that may come up are how much to charge military personnel for their health care in the TRICARE system, which is the defense health system. The administration has proposed maybe raising the fees a little bit. This bill is likely to say, no, you can't do that. So it's really it's a wide-ranging bill because the Defense Department is huge. There's a lot of money involved. Procurement's a huge part of this bill because the Defense Department has so many contracts with so many places around the country. So this is often the first way to test a new approach to acquisition is to get the Defense Department to sign on to it first.
In the time that we have left, real quick, I want to get your take on Richard Lugar. Margaret Carlson penned a piece for Bloomberg View earlier. It said, Republican moderates are no longer a dying breed. With the defeat of Senator Richard Lugar of Indiana, they are dead.
Well, it's certainly a lot of people are feeling that way today. Yeah. You know, John Kerry yesterday said that it was a tragedy for the Senate that Richard Lugar had been defeated. And you could see why, maybe for Kerry, because they've worked very closely together on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He's a guy that's been around for 36 years. Some would argue that the party has moved more to the right while he's still been a person who will cut deals with members of the other party to really get things done. One of his signature bills is the Nunn-Lugar bill, which is about reducing weapons, and that was co-authored with the Democrat, Sam Nunn. We see a little less of that now than we did maybe 20 years ago. But, you know, he lost by 20 points. Some people point to his vote on the bank bailouts in 2008 or, you know, other votes he's made since then. And people will see it as a big loss. Now, the Democrats who were bemoaning his departure may also see it as a chance to pick up that seat. We have a story in Bloomberg News today that, you know, there's Joe Donnelly, who's the congressman running most likely for the Democratic nomination, or who has the Democratic nomination, stands a better chance against Murdoch than he did against Richard Lugar. So we'll see what that does for Senate control, but that will certainly be heating up as the year goes on.
Only time will tell, sir. Lauren Duggan, congressional analyst, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Brian Rye as well. Thank you for coming in and being a part of Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact. We are just about done here on Capital Impact right here on Federal News Radio. Just a reminder, you can learn more about BGov's award-winning analysis, tools, and data at www.bgov.com. That's bgov.com. You can follow us on Twitter at BloombergGov. My thanks to Christopher Flavell, whose study, Managed Care, Push Not Explained by Medicaid Cost Growth Alone. This is just part one of three, by the way. Look for part two on BGov soon. Brian Rye's Comparative Effectiveness Research, Implications for the Healthcare Industry, is also available for download at www.bgov.com. That's BGov.com. Let's plan on getting together again next Thursday, shall we? Right around 11 a.m. Lots more to say about the business impact of government actions. For BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, AM 1500, I'm Alan Scott.